Guns?
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Peter Guns. I'm the attorney for Metro. Metro appeals the dismissal below of four claims asserted against its former franchisor and landlord, ExxonMobil, and the distributor to whom its service station was sold, Anacostia. Those claims were for non-renewal and violation of the PMPA, for violation of the D.C. Right of First Refusal Act, for breach of contract arising out of the increased burdens of the assignment, and for civil conspiracy to violate the D.C. Right of First Refusal Act. I'd like to discuss first the non-renewal and violation of the Petroleum Marketing Practices Act. The key events that form the basis of Metro's PMPA non-renewal claim are, one, that in June of 2009, ExxonMobil assigned what remained of the Metro's three-year franchise agreement term to Anacostia. On July 2009, a month later, the franchise agreement expired by its own terms. On its face, the franchise agreement provided that any extension would not be, and I quote, a renewal of the agreement or of the franchise relationship. The agreement further provided on its face that absent a renewal agreement, Metro Oil may not hold itself out as a franchise dealer or have a permitted use of the proprietary marks. Thus, the franchise agreement, by its express terms, ended both the franchise and the franchise relationship as of a date certain.
Have they done anything to prevent you from obtaining fuel or keeping the property or using the marks?
No, that's not in dispute. We do not contend that any of the three components that would be necessary in a case for constructive termination have been disturbed.
So if that's the case, needless to say, or maybe it's not needless to say, but a contract that says something is non-renewal or renewal is not binding on us as an interpretation of the statute, correct?
Well, Your Honor, I submit that it is because of the PMPA.
You think that the parties can bind us to an interpretation of the PMPA?
Only in a sense, because the PMPA itself sets when non-renewal occurs, and this is in 280.114a.
Right,
and
so
it says that non-renewal occurs on the expiration of the term. So in a sense, since the term, expiration of the term is set, then the non-renewal kicks in, and then, in fact, that's it. And in fact,
But the full provision that you're talking about says the term non-renewal means failure to reinstate, continue, or extend at the conclusion of the or expiration of the term. And here, the franchise relationship has continued in the statutory sense of the three requirements.
Well,
so how do you get around that problem?
Two ways. And I think first is to look at the Ninth Circuit's opinion in Dufresne. In that situation, really paralleled where we were. That's the opinion at 920 F. Second. And the timeline there was that in 1987.
I'm sorry, say the name of the case again.
I'm probably mispronouncing it. Dufresne. I'm a New Jerseyan, and we mispronounce everything. But I do know numbers. It's 992 F. Second 920. And in that case, Shell assigned the dealer's franchise agreements to the distributor. The pre-existing franchise agreements, and that was in 1987. The next year, the pre-existing franchise agreements expired by their terms. But the dealers continued to operate as service station dealers supplied by the distributors. The dealers did get around to asserting a non-renewal claim under the PMPA in 1990.
I just pause. I'm trying to find my notes on this. Was this case cited in your reply brief?
Yes, Your Honor. It was first cited by Anacostia in its brief. And we took a hard look at it, and we said, hey, this case says exactly what we wanted.
I mispronounced it, too. Okay, I got it.
Anyway, in 1990, the dealers attempted to assert a non-renewal claim, and Shell defended under the PMPA, saying, look, the contract expired in 1988. under the definition of termination non-renewal, that did it, and therefore we're out. The appeals court agreed. It affirmed summary judgment for Shell because under 280114A, it said non-renewal occurred on the expiration date stated in the dealer's franchise. Here, likewise, Metroil's non-renewal claim ripened at the expiration date because Metroil's franchise agreement and franchise relationship ended when the franchise agreement said it ended over 2 years ago. And what the Dufresne opinion, the Ninth Circuit opinion, really highlights the Sullen Charybdis situation the dealer faced. What is the dealer to do after franchise expires by its own terms? If he stays, according to the district court, he can't fight non-renewal, but the limitations still run, according to Dufresne. If he leaves, he forfeits his right to a preliminary injunction, which is a key element of the PMPA under 2805, while he challenges non-renewal. In other words, the only way...
I guess I'm not understanding the problem. If we were to regard this as continuing, then they would have to give you the appropriate notice and everything else before they could cease providing one of the three pillars. So why, at that point, you could sue. How does that prevent you from suing?
First of all, according to Dufresne...
Well, Dufresne's a Ninth Circuit case that's not going to control us. So the real question is, what's the... You know, we have a statute, and so I want to know what... We don't have to worry about the intricacies of what their district court there said. I want to know about here, why isn't that sufficient protection for you? That if they are going to withdraw one of the pillars, they have to give you the notice, and at that point, you have a claim, and you can bring all the claims that you've brought here with respect to the PMPA.
Well, for one reason, that what it does is it reduces the dealer's ability to sell his business. You're not going to be able to sell a service station if you don't have a current franchise agreement. In fact, in all these station sales, the first condition of sale is, will the supplier approve the transfer of the franchise agreement? So if you put in this void, and in a void where if anybody looks at that franchise agreement, they're going to say, hey, the franchise agreement says that not only has the franchise relationship terminated, but you don't have a right to hold yourself out as a dealer or use the license agreements. I mean, that is just the kind of situation that makes a dealer impossible. I mean, what happened in Dufresne, and we submit what's happening here, is in effect the supplier, by not doing what he's supposed to do at the end of the franchise term, is really playing a game of rope-a-dope. And he's reduced the dealer to his status where, under the lower court's opinion, the only way he can clarify his status is to walk out of the station and leave his business. And that's totally against the policy of the PMPA, Your Honor. And it's also so unnecessary because the statute on its face says only, look, when the term ends, come up with a new franchise agreement or do a notice of non-renewal. So there's no burden on the other side to do it the right way. And we submit, Your Honor, that they simply didn't do it that way. Your Honor, I would next like to address the right of first refusal claim. I'd just briefly like to talk about the events that led up to the passage of the statute, because I think it puts the act in context. In early 2009, the council recognized an urgent situation, a need to protect dealers and the public from ExxonMobil's announced intention to sell off its stations. On April 2, 2009, the proposed right of first refusal bill is amended to exclude only contracts entered into prior to April 1, 2009. Within a week, on April 7th, council passes the right of refusal act. It's signed by the mayor, and the congressional review period commences. And there's no way for the council to get around the congressional review period. It's going to be there. On June 16th, ExxonMobil sells the stations to Anacostia during the review period without providing the mandated right of first refusal. It's fair to say that the council is incensed by Exxon's actions, and there is emergency resolution introduced condemning the sale and expressly confirming what the council's original intent was as to ensure that a franchisee possesses a right of first refusal before any sale occurring on or after April 1, 2009.
That resolution failed, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but...
So what does that tell us that the resolution... It seems to me the resolution hurts you in two respects. A, it failed, and B, it confirms or indicates that the original legislation did not do what the resolution was trying to do.
To answer both points, the key point is that all eight councilpersons who originally voted the act into law voted for the resolution and said that was their intent. So I'm not, the fact of whether it passes or fails isn't to us germane. What's germane is that you have the councilpersons who voted for the original act saying what the original act meant. That's point number one. And I think, I'm sorry, Your Honor, your second point?
Well, the mere fact that they had to do it or thought that they had to do it indicates that by its terms, the original legislation did not accomplish that goal of indicating retroactivity or an effective date before July. And that's a problem for you under the D.C. case law, which says things like it needs to be clear, it needs to be unequivocal, it needs to plainly appear to be retroactive.
Well, I think, though, that what the cases also say is that legislative history and legislative intent are the key area in both retroactive and prospective litigation.
But post-enactment statements of legislators is very weak form of legislative history.
But this is,
it's not history, first of all.
It is in this case, though, the statement is so strong and it covers all the initial eight council persons that I think it's in a lead by itself. I mean, I've never seen a case like that, not that I know that much on this area, but it really is strong.
Well, lots of times members of Congress will say that's not what we intended the legislation to be. But the mere fact that they say that in a speech on the floor of the House or Senate is meaningless unless that concern that they have gets enacted into legislation
right. Signed
by the president.
No, I understand. But at your second point, whether they thought that they had a problem, what I think they saw is that they were going to be facing a challenge on it. And they were incensed at what ExxonMobil had done. And so,
it might have been
the lower court did see it differently. And so they were trying to make sure that their original intent was preserved. Mm-hmm. And that's what they said. And they specifically referred back to their original intent when they voted the bill in. And as also to your point, Your Honor, on this, there was a lot of reliance below on the generalized presumption. But I think that it ate up the key element when you look at any legislation, which is the court's function is to discern what the intent of the legislation was consistent with the language and their act thereon. I think what this court said a long time ago in the Kindleberger case, and this is 155 F. 2nd at 286.
That is a long time ago.
Yeah, but a lot of good things were said a long time ago. And what the court said was the Constitution does not forbid retrospective laws merely because of the retrospective aspect. And whether a statute operates retrospectively or only prospectively depends on the legislative intent.
The Constitution doesn't
prohibit
it, but because it's in tension with rule of law values, the Supreme Court on the federal side and a lot of the state courts, including the D.C. court on the local side, have adopted a presumption because of those rule of law values that kick in when you're talking about retroactive legislation.
I agree that a lot of cases, and particularly older cases, that, mm-hmm. that deal strongly with presumption. But I pinpoint the second half of the Kindleberger, which says, and whether a statute operates retrospectively or only prospectively depends on the legislative intent.
Right, but if it's murky as to not that it's urgent, but whether it should apply retroactively, which are two different issues, then the presumption has to be the deciding factor, doesn't it?
Well, I don't think a presumption is, frankly, Your Honor, is ever a deciding factor. I think it's something that has to be overcome. And I think here it's overcome by the clear statement of all eight counsel person as to what they meant. And I think that defeats the presumption. Your Honor, I have just a very little time, and frankly, I think the other two counts are addressed in our briefs, and that's all I have, unless there are further questions.
Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Guntz.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Klapaw. And I may have mispronounced that along with...
No, actually, you pronounced it right. One of about six people in my life who's done that on the first try.
When you get a chance, if you could distinguish the unpronounceable case, that would be helpful.
The Dufresne case, yes. Certainly, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Mark Klapaw on behalf of the ExxonMobil parties. I'm going to talk for 10 minutes with the Court's permission on counts 1, 4, and 5, and then Mr. Alfano will take on the other issues in the remainder of the time. Let me start by distinguishing the Dufresne case, and then I'll launch into my presentation. The Dufresne case, which, as you point out, is out of the Ninth Circuit and therefore not binding on this Court, in fact, did not find a non-renewal. What it found was that if one was claiming non-renewal, one would have to bring it within the one-year period of time, and the allegations in that case were that the 1 year had expired.
But was there a debate in that case? Looking at it quickly on Westlaw, I'm unable to get the complete analysis of the case in my mind. I see one side of the issue was when did it officially expire under the terms. Was there the same argument here that your side is making, that it was continued because the three pillars were continued?
Correct, Your Honor. That is our position. However,
was
this
that,
case...
Was that true in that case, in the Ninth Circuit case?
I don't recall, Your Honor. But let me focus on this point, which is that in this case, the PMPA agreement had not reached the end of its initial term by the point of assignment. Let me talk about the PMPA since Mr. Guntz focused on it initially. As Your Honor correctly noted, the statute defines when a non-renewal occurs. It defines it explicitly as a failure to reinstate, continue, or extend the franchise relationship. As every court that has considered this issue has pointed out, the franchise relationship is not the franchise contract. It is simply the three pillars, the use of the trademark, the supply of motor fuel, and the station lease. And we heard Mr. Guntz again acknowledge today, there is no dispute in this case. The dealer continues to use the Exxon trademark, continues to buy Exxon-branded motor fuel, and continues to lease the station, even to this day. Thus, the franchise relationship remains intact, and there is no PMPA claim. And for that reason...
And what happens, in your view, if that relationship changes when there's no contract in existence?
Say it again, Your Honor. If it changes when it's not
there's
in existence?
No contract in existence.
The facts of this case are that the assignment was made before the
contract.
You want
case.
Forget the facts of this case. Okay.
You've got a franchise relationship the way you're describing it, but the contract has expired. So you have a person operating in a relationship with no contract. What protections, if any, does that person have under the statute if an attempt is made to now end the relationship?
If an attempt were made to now end the relationship, the franchisee would have all the same rights under the PMPA against Anacostia as it would have before the assignment against ExxonMobil. So there's no diminution.
With or without the contract.
With or without the contract. There is no diminution in the rights that the franchisee has as a protection. Nor was it, excuse me.
I'll let you finish. It's my fault. Go ahead.
Nor was it the purpose of the PMPA, as described, to protect the value to the dealer. Rather, the clear purpose of the PMPA, as many courts have said, was to prevent unlawful termination or non-renewal. The fact that there may be economic consequences to the decisions of the franchisor were not protected under that statute.
And the one additional point, as I understand it, they're particularly concerned about is you may have a right under a statute, but it's not assignable if you try and sell the business.
That's correct.
Yeah, well, then that's a real problem without a contract.
Well, that's not a problem that the PMPA was designed to resolve.
I understand. I'm just trying to understand your interpretation of the statute,
right,
and how it relates to the presence or absence of a contract.
Okay. Let me move on to the Retail Service Station Amendment Act of 2009. It's undisputed that ExxonMobil completed the sale of the property to Anacostia prior to its effective date. As Your Honors pointed out, there is a clear presumption that has been repeatedly articulated by the Supreme Court and by this Court against the retroactive application of legislation. Unless a statute clearly expresses its retroactivity, it only operates prospectively. And we don't have to reach back decades for those pronouncements. That's Landgraf, 1994.
Just as a technical matter, don't we apply D.C. law to this question, not federal law?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
So Landgraf is useful to the extent the D.C. courts have followed it, but doesn't dictate how we go about this.
Right. The D.C. This court in Holzinger articulated that same presumption against retroactivity requiring a clear statement of legislative
intent. Not this court, the D.C. Court of Appeals.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Yes,
by the way, better for you in this case. Yes. Unlike the Ninth Circuit, the D.C. Court of Appeals actually does matter in this case.
Right. Correct.
No disrespect intended for the Ninth Circuit. Simply doesn't apply in the same way the D.C. Court of Appeals does.
We understand. Metrorail's advanced two arguments against in favor of retroactivity. First, they've pointed to the Act's Savings Clause, which by its terms excludes transactions made pursuant to a contract that's dated before April 1st, 2009. It's a clause of exclusion that narrows the scope of the Act, not expands it. There is no way to read that clause to sweep in transactions that are not already covered by the Act. So it is not a clear statement of retroactive intent, in fact, the opposite. Then we get to this failed subsequent resolution on which it seems Metroil is putting a lot of stock. They point to this resolution which says it was supposed to, quote unquote, clarify the retroactivity of the Act. But as this Court has said, failed subsequent legislation is not a reliable basis to infer the meaning of a statute, much less to find the clear statement that we need here for retroactivity. For that reason, Metroil is unable to show you any case anywhere in which a failed subsequent resolution stands as the acknowledged basis for finding retroactivity. Moreover, as Judge Urbina correctly noted below, and you all pointed out, the only possible reason for the Act sponsor to introduce a resolution to clarify the retroactivity of the Act is because they didn't think it was there in the first place.
Well, to be fair, it may be because they knew this lawsuit was coming and they wanted to eliminate the lawsuit. It doesn't necessarily mean that they thought it was necessary. They just thought they wanted to be absolutely clear.
But if it was clear, there would have been no
reason.
I should
put it another way. They weren't absolutely clear in the sense of precluding this your defense.
Right. But there's also no doubt about what the council had to do and could have done had it wanted the statute to apply retroactively because the standard is well known. They could have put in a clear statement when they initially passed the Act. They could have put it in after. They could put it in today. That didn't happen.
So they could have, at the time they did the emergency legislation, they could have instead used regular legislation, which would have no doubt taken longer. But they could have made it retroactive to include this transaction?
That's correct. As Mr. Guntz pointed out, a constitutionally acceptable in many circumstances to have retroactive application of statutes. I'm not taking a position today on, had that happened, whether or not we would have a different constitutional problem, you understand. In my last few minutes, I just wanted to say a few words on the breach of contract claim. As you all know, the free assignability of contracts is favored in D.C., such that even in the absence of a clause saying so, the right to assign is presumed. We don't have to go there here because the contract that Metroil actually signed and that was in effect as of the date of the assignment, says explicitly ExxonMobil was free to assign it. And that contract even puts the franchisee on notice that assignment may have adverse consequences to Metroil. including, quote, that the new franchisee will have policies or programs that differ from ExxonMobil's policies or programs.
What is it that the court said they could make claims about later?
Sorry?
The district judge in this case said that if claims arise later,
correct.
What kind of claims?
Sure. So that was discussed both in the context of the PMPA and in the context of a breach of contract to focus on the fact that there is no diminution in the rights that the franchisee is afforded. If Anacostia breaches the contract today, they can raise a claim for breach of contract.
What is the contract? Since the contract expired, what is the contract?
There would be, from ExxonMobil's perspective, and not necessarily Anacostia's, there's an oral contract that continues. What the nature of that oral contract is factual issues that we don't have positions on.
Mm-hmm. And under the PMPA, you would agree that would your position be that once one of the pillars is, at least one of the pillars is withdrawn, then the PMPA kicks in? And you'd have to give the appropriate notice before that moment, before you can withdraw any of the pillars.
Correct. Although, again, that's not ExxonMobil's issue at this point, right?
Well, I just want to be clear.
That's our position.
It is an issue because if this eliminated their ability to use the PMPA at all, that would suggest we're using the wrong definition of non-renewal. So it is your issue. So tell me what you think.
Sure. So our position is that the PMPA continues to protect them. If one of the three pillars is taken out from under them in some hypothetical scenario in the future, they will have a PMPA non-renewal claim. Mm-hmm. And then to deal with the Supreme Court's issue in Max Shell, everybody will know whether or not the dealer has a position on termination or non-renewal and when the arrangement ends, as opposed to the scenario Mr. Guntz suggests, in which we all on this side will be left wondering, when is it that that our obligations cease? When is it that they think that there's a termination or non-renewal?
And you think it's when one of the pillars is withdrawn, is that right?
Vis-a-vis non-renewal, correct.
Yeah. Well, also vis-a-vis termination, but that's not an issue here.
Right? That's right. Yeah. They've pointed to Section 210.2 of the D.C. Commercial Code. And again, I'll just point out, they haven't shown you any case in any jurisdiction, although dealers have been arguing this section of the Uniform Commercial Code for decades. They can't show you any case in which any court has rejected a PMPA assignment on the basis of a shift in the burdens. I see that my time is up. I'm happy to continue on this issue, or I'll turn it over to Mr. Alfano, as you like.
Mr. Alfano, thank you.
May it please the court, Al Alfano for the defendant, appellee, Anacostia Realty, LLC. Anacostia, as you know, was the entity that purchased the service station from ExxonMobil. The only claim that's asserted against Anacostia in the complaint, as opposed to ExxonMobil, is a claim for civil conspiracy. The theory is that ExxonMobil and Anacostia conspired with one another to deprive the plaintiff of his right to first refusal under the D.C. Retail Service Station Act. And the theory is that a common law doctrine like civil conspiracy can be used to make Anacostia vicariously liable for a statutory violation by ExxonMobil. Now, the district court didn't pass on this issue because it found that, in fact, there was no statutory violation. And we urge the court to affirm on that basis for the reason stated just a moment ago by Mr. Klapow. But should the court allow the statutory claim to proceed, we would urge the court to affirm the dismissal of Anacostia on the ground that the plaintiff has failed to state a legally sufficient claim for civil conspiracy. There's no dispute that civil conspiracy is derived from the law of torts, and there's no dispute that civil conspiracy is not an independent cause of action that can stand on its own. It's simply a doctrine or a means of permitting a plaintiff to hold one of the conspiring parties liable for an underlying tort committed by one of the other conspirators. And in Halberstrom, this court gave definition to the elements of a civil conspiracy, and that is an agreement to perform an unlawful act or to perform a lawful act through unlawful means. And then there has to be an overt tortious act in furtherance of the conspiracy. Now, the question presented here is whether or not the doctrine of civil conspiracy should be expanded to include circumstances where the only overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy is a statutory violation. And I say expanded because we're aware of no D.C. case that in which there was a successful claim of civil conspiracy or a civil conspiracy claim that survived a motion to dismiss where the overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy wasn't a tort that was recognized at common law.
But the Hall versus Clinton case, the reason that we rejected the case was it was a conspiracy to violate a statute which did not itself provide a private cause of action. And this statute does provide a private cause of action.
There's somewhat confusion. The court first said that that the Hatch Act is not a tort. Okay, that was the first pronouncement. And then it said that because there was no private right of action in an individual under the Hatch Act, where the government was the only party that was capable of bringing a lawsuit, right, that it wasn't actionable. But there was somewhat a little bit confusing as to what the basis was as to whether or not the Hatch Act not being a tort was the reason, as opposed to the non-actionability by an individual. But we would say to the court that where there is a tort, where a common law tort is alleged as the overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy, the policy to be vindicated in a lawsuit brought under civil conspiracy theory is a policy derived from the common law. Where there is no tort, defamation, assault, fraud, the only policy to be vindicated is a creature of statute. And out of respect for the legislature, or perhaps on separation of powers grounds, the remedies that are available for a statutory violation should be the remedies that are set forth in the statute itself, and that the court should not use a common law doctrine to expand the remedies available under a statute.
I'm not sure how the separation of powers applies here. After all we're doing here is interpreting D.C. law, and there's no constitutional separation of powers between the D.C. Court of Appeals and the D.C. legislature. There are statutory separations that Congress has set up, but there isn't the same kind of separation of power concern you're talking about. And in any event, it doesn't apply to us. The issue for us is, what would D.C. do?
Well, the D.C. court, out of respect for the legislature, decide that we're not going to use a common law doctrine to expand the remedies of the statute beyond what was intended by the legislature.
We have an argument, as either of my colleagues have.
Do you agree that you have an oral contract with the franchisee?
Yes.
What's the sweep of it?
The sweep is the original written contract. In other words, the letters that they received was that the original contract was being extended, so that the oral contract encompasses the terms and conditions of the original contract. And if we wanted to terminate the relationship or non-renew the relationship, we'd have to give them notice under the PMPA, 90 days notice of non-renewal. They would have the full panoply of rights that are available under the PMPA, including preliminary and permanent injunctive relief and damages. So they have the full protection of the PMPA as we sit here today, in the event that the franchise is terminated or there's a non-renewal of the franchise relationship.
What's the term of the oral contract? Of
There has no definite term, and under the PMPA, a franchise is defined as an oral or written contract, and also in any oral contract situation, the appropriate means of ending the franchise is through non-renewal because an oral contract is of indefinite duration.
So the implication, though, is that at any point you can give 90 days notice?
No.
No. Then I didn't understand.
There would have to be a ground for non-renewal. There is no ground for non-renewal. The only way we could, if they fail to pay...
Because the original contract has a requirement for grounds for non-renewal. Is that why there has to be...
No, because the PMPA has
grounds. Because the PMPA, yeah.
It's a statutory requirement. The exclusive grounds for non-renewal are set forth in the PMPA, preempts all state law in the area, so that if there were grounds for non-renewal, we could renew. Or we could offer now a new contract. And if they refuse the new contract, changes the conditions that are offered in good faith in the normal course of business, if they refused it, we could non-renew on that basis. And that's a legitimate basis under the PMPA.
Can they sell the business with the rights of the oral contract preserved?
Yeah, I mean, what they could do is they could sell the business, and but they would need our consent either way. I mean, if we had a written contract, let's say the written contract hadn't expired, they would need our consent. And if they want to sell the business now, they would need our consent. In the same way, we would look to see whether or not the buyer is creditworthy and so forth, and the same considerations would be applied.
So are they at any disadvantage? I mean, you heard the point made by opposing counsel that it makes it more difficult to sell because they don't have a written written renewal. Do you see any disadvantage?
There might be some. A buyer technically might come in and see that there's not a written contract, and the buyer may be less inclined to.
There'll be a psychological one.
Psychological.
But from a legal point of view, in terms of what they can sell, it would be the same regardless.
Yeah, they could. They have a franchise. The constraint on their selling doesn't really change from our perspective if they have a written contract or if they don't, because we have to consent in either case. And the set of considerations that we would have as to whether or not we would consent to an assignment or to a new buyer are the same. They're prudential considerations based on creditworthiness, business experience, and things like that.
Okay.
I have nothing further?
No, thank you.
Your Honors, I would like to address the final point from counsel for Anacostia about the oral contract. That's the first I ever heard of it. We never agreed to an oral contract. We have no idea what the terms of it are. And this business about sending out letters, in fact, as we mentioned in the brief, there were, I think, one letter, and it was for a period, not for the entire 2.5 years, but for a certain number of months in it, and that's the only letter we ever got. Second, to suggest that it doesn't impact termination under the PMPA, we submit is just wrong, because under Section 2802 of the PMPA provides that a grounds for termination or non-renewal is a breach of a material term of the franchise agreement. We don't know what the material terms of the franchise agreement are because there is no material, because there is no franchise agreement.
I understand counsel. He's saying the oral agreement is coterminous with the prior written agreement.
Well, I always thought to have an oral agreement, you needed both parties agreeing on that. And not only did we not agree to it, they never even proposed it. So to our point, there's just no oral contract. The other point that counsel made, that it really didn't matter with outside seller, is we submit wrong, because if a dealer has an existing franchise agreement and he can transfer it to a buyer, the grounds for non-renewal and termination are those set forth in the PMPA for franchise agreements, which means they have to have cause of a material breach or something like a conviction of a felony. Without a franchise agreement, they can, and what they would do at most, if they agree to anything, would they would give the new dealer a trial franchise. Under a trial franchise, it only lasts 1 year, and it can be terminated for any reason or no reason. No outside buyer is right mind is going to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for a business if he knows that the cornerstone of the business can simply walk away with it from the deal, with or without reason, with or without cause, after 1 year. So, in fact, we submit there is a significant difference as a result in the change in the status. Since Your Honor had doubts about Ninth Circuit, I did want to cite something from the First Circuit.
No, to be clear.
well, a lot of people.
Only doubt is whether it's binding, not whether it's persuasive.
I understand.
So I'm asking you to explain the reason for their position rather than simply say because they said so.
Right. Well, I would point out.
With respect to the D.C. Court of Appeals, you can say just because they said so.
Exactly.
That's enough for us.
That's right. But there is another case I'd like to mention, which is the C.K. Smith & Co. case It's a District of Mass case. It's also referred to in Anacostia's opposition and in our reply. It's 126 F sub 2nd 34. And at that point, the dealer, the contract terminated because the dealer didn't sign it. But they continued to supply, and they continued to operate. And they went in and said, hey, wait a second, we're still good. And the court threw them out and said, no, the franchise relationship terminated when that contract ended. And I'll quote from page 37.
Could you give the full cite there?
Yes, Your Honor. The full cite is 126 F sup 2nd 34, and this is 37. When a franchise expires, the franchise relationship between the parties continues, and it is that relationship which the franchise was obligated to renew under 2802 under the requirements. So it did deal with a franchise relationship. But then the court went on to say is that because there had been no new franchise agreement, that it was too late, and that, in fact, it would put an undue burden on the supplier if the supplier wasn't assured of the certainty of the expiration of the franchise contract. So we submit that is further support. Also, with this dichotomy now that ExxonMobil would draw between with the franchise relationship and the franchise, if that's so, why in heaven's name did ExxonMobil put its own contract of adhesion that not only the agreement but the franchise relationship itself terminated at the end of the term? Why did ExxonMobil put in a provision which said the dealer no longer had the right to use proprietary marks, which is one of the three key elements of the franchise relationship? I think that, well, I shouldn't say that. The contract should be taken for what it says it says. And what it says is it's over, it's kaput. And even ExxonMobil at council today said, in talking about the Dufresne case, that the only way the dealer could challenge the fact that he didn't get a new agreement is to walk away from the station. And that would forfeit the preliminary injunction rights. The whole purpose and the loosened preliminary injunction standard 2805 is to say, look, dealer, if you've got a dispute about termination of non-renewal, you don't have to give up your station. But what Dufresne's saying and what ExxonMobil's own counsel is saying is, well, that's not true. If we sit on our hands and do nothing, then the only way you can challenge our failure to give you a franchise agreement is to walk out and to end your business. And, Your Honor, that is not the law. It is absolutely counter to what the intention of the law is.
Okay. I want to make sure I understand what your proposed remedy is here. They properly assigned their contract, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
They were entitled to sell to Anacostia.
Except that under the D.C. statute, if they increased the burdens on us.
The D.C. statute, that's we have to decide whether it's retroactive or not.
No, you're
talking about the other deal.
The UCC.
Right.
From that, they would have a right to assign.
Okay. Assuming there's no increased burden.
Right.
Okay, your contract theory, that's what you're talking about.
Right.
Okay. And now you're in a situation where then your contract expires.
Right.
After they have properly sold what they had to Anacostia.
And assign the supplier agreement. Okay. And assign the lease.
What is it you're now entitled to as against Anacostia?
Well, what I'm entitled to against Anacostia, and we're talking now under the PMPA.
Well, I don't know. That's what I'm asking. I want to make sure I'm understanding. Now I'm a little bit perplexed. The longer I listen to the argument, the more perplexed I am. They have a right, assuming there's no UCC argument. I'm not judging it. I'm just saying assuming it so I can get this straight in my head. And assuming there's no retroactivity, so you don't have that available, there's only the PMPA. You agree they properly sold their rights to Anacostia.
Right.
Okay, then your contract, pre-existing contract, expires.
Right.
And who is obliged to do what to you? What is the remedy in those circumstances?
At that point, your franchisor is obligated under the PMPA to provide you a new agreement or to provide 90 days notice of non-renewal.
Okay, So you're saying Anacostia has that obligation.
If
did your complaint embrace them?
Yes.
Under
yes.
the PMPA?
Yes. Our PMPA count was brought against both ExxonMobil and Anacostia.
So you're saying PMPA cannot leave you in a limbo.
That's right.
You either have a new contract or you have to get notice.
Right. And in fact, in all those PMPA cases where there have been transfers to distributors where the dealers have lost, the argument has been, well, the distributor stepped in the shoes of the refiner and had the exact same duties under the PMPA. And they don't dispute that. PMPA is clear that there reaches contracts between distributors and dealers. So there's a violation here. Somebody had an obligation to offer us a new agreement. If, in fact, the assignment was wrongful and should have gone down, then clearly it would have been ExxonMobil. Otherwise, somebody had to do it.
But that would be the only grounds on which it was ExxonMobil who had to do it.
That would be right. I mean, I think that if, in fact, it's a valid assignment, I think that the new obligation, the violation of the PMPA, would be from Anacostia.
Would have to be.
Yes, that's what I think.
Okay, thank you. We'll take another submission. We'll take a brief recess.